Okay, I'm here. It's Gary Parrish again. This is the Eye on College Basketball Podcast again. And I'm talking to you now in the morning of November 21st, otherwise known as just a few hours after Iowa State got its second quality win of the month at BYU late on Wednesday night. Fred Hoiberg off to a nice start this season. Beat Michigan on Sunday, then backed it with a win at the Marriott Center. We might get into that a little bit later, but right now, I don't want to look back as much as I want to look forward, and forward specifically to the 2K Sports Classic that's going to be tonight at New York's Madison Square Garden. It's a doubleheader. It's got Connecticut, Boston College, got Indiana, Washington. Rob Doster is going to be there at MSG. He, of course, writes for NBCSports.com's College Basketball Talk. And even though he has a train to catch this morning into the city, he's nice enough to join me on the podcast. Rob, what's going on, man?
You're waking me up bright and early, Gary.
I have been up hours. See, I can't wait till you get a fifth grader, because then you'll have been up for hours by now. The fifth graders, they make it really tough. I stayed up last night to watch the end of the Grizzlies game. They went into overtime. They were out in Golden State. That's obviously late for a guy in the Central time zone. And I had somebody go, man, it is late. I've got class in the morning. He was a college student. I said, listen, you can skip your college 8 a.m. class. You can't not wake your fifth grader up for school. So I'm exhausted at this point myself.
Well, if you ask my fiance, she'll tell you that she already has a fifth grader to take care of in the house. So
I understand that. Well, listen, okay, so let's get to it. I know you got to catch a train. Connecticut, BC tonight, Indiana, Washington. I'm assuming this is going to be your first look of the year at Noah Vonleh, IU's freshman big who's averaging 15 and 13. Tom Crean, I guess it was the other day, maybe it was last week, he said he wouldn't trade Noah for any other freshman. So let me ask you, does he belong, Vonleh, in the same conversation as Wiggins, Randall, Parker, and Gordon?
Well, he's certainly putting up the numbers that, that'll make you believe so. But if you look at who Indiana's actually played, I don't think they've beaten anybody worth noting at all. I mean, Long Island's pretty good, but they're missing their big guy, Julian Boyd. So that's probably what I'm the most looking forward to. This weekend is just getting a chance to see him go against some, you know, quality talent and some guys that might actually challenge him a little bit, because, you know, I saw him play on the AAU circuit and he's really, really good. He plays hard and he's a lot of fun to watch. So I'm really intrigued to see what he can actually do against someone, you know, his size and kind of his talent level.
You know, I am too. I mean, we've got to see all those kids, or at least three of them, Wiggins, Randall, and Parker, on a big stage Champions Classic last week. And then, you know, I guess we've seen Aaron Gordon, or at least I have a few times on television already, most notably at San Diego State. But Vonleh, I haven't seen him yet on television, just, you know, I guess because Indiana hasn't played a compelling game yet. So I'm actually looking forward to this as well. They did lose, despite the fact that they're ranked, I think, in one poll right now, maybe not the other. You know, they lost two top five picks in Zeller and Oladipo. How good is this Indiana team this season? And are they being ranked right now more on name, or do they have a legitimate top 25 team?
I think they're being ranked on name right now because we don't really know how good this team actually is. I think they're going to be a lot better in March once they kind of solidify their roles. And you know, they got a lot of young guys, and even some of their sophomores didn't really play all that much last season. So they got people kind of learning new roles. And, you know, obviously Yogi Ferrell, he's going from a guy that kind of ran the point and got the ball to Cody Zeller, to a guy that's got to really be the go-to guy and the leader on that team. So that takes a little while to learn how to do. So I think that they're going to be good come March. I think that they have top 25 talent, but I think that it's one of those teams where, you know, same thing with like a Michigan or a Kentucky. Sure. They're kind of working through, you know, learning their new roles and kind of establishing who's going to do this and who's going to do that. But there's definitely talent on that roster.
So also tonight at MSG, Connecticut there, they're 4-0. They're ranked 18th in the country. Napier and Boatrider. It's a weird stat. Somebody tweeted it, and I didn't know if I should take it at face value, so I actually went and looked it up, and it's true. The two little guards are leading UConn in points. I don't think that's surprising, but also in rebounds per game. Napier's averaging 14 and 10 rebounds, which is wild because, again, he's just 6'1". How far can those guards carry UConn, and do they really need to be leading the team in rebounds as well?
Well, they have to, because UConn doesn't have any big guys.
No.
I mean, if you look at the players on their roster, I think their best big man, their most experienced big man, is Tyler Olander. And he averaged, what, like 4.3 points last year or something like that. So, You know, they got a freshman named Amita Brima who's big. He blocks shots, but he probably weighs like 195 pounds, and he's 7 feet tall. So you can kind of push him anywhere you need him to go. And if you watch them play, what they do is it seems like Ali is kind of telling his big guys, you know, look, just don't let your guy get the rebound, and we're going to have Baz and Bolt come in here and grab and get all the loose balls and everything. So I think that kind of plays a role in it too. Because they're not really leaking out. They're not really getting out in transition as much as they have in the past. So I think that's kind of part of it. But I don't think that that's sustainable, especially once you start playing, you know, better competition. The good news for UConn is in their last game, DeAndre Daniels looked like he kind of broke out of his slump. He had 24 points. And I think he's the X factor for that team because he's the guy that kind of gives them, you know, another dimension. We know about the guards that they have, but DeAndre Daniels, he's a 6'9" athletic wing. He blocks some shots. Theoretically, he can get a couple of rebounds if you need him. So I think he's a guy that kind of brings another dimension to that roster.
You mentioned Kevin Ollie. He's obviously going to get a lot of face time tonight. Has this been a smoother transition from the Jim Calhoun to the Kevin Ollie era than you anticipated? It seems to going remarkably well right now.
Yeah, I did not see him being this good this quickly. And I'll tell you what, I'm from Connecticut. I grew up a Connecticut fan. All my friends back home are Connecticut fans. And I think to a man, everybody is just in love with Kevin Ollie. And you know, everyone liked him from the get-go. He's sure. Just one of those guys that he ended up making, a 12-year NBA career out of not really being able to do anything all that well. So he's a guy that you root for. He works hard. He coaches hard. He's a nice guy. So I think that, you know, that kind of plays a role in it as well. But, yeah, they're a lot better and a lot quicker than I expected. They don't have any big men on the roster. They basically have three really, really good guards, and they've managed to become a top 15 team out of it, top 20 team, for 2 years in a row now. So, I don't think there's any way you can not say that they're kind of outliving expectations right now.
So UConn's guards are going to be on display tonight on national television. Two nights ago, it was another American Athletic Conference team that had its guards on display. It was Memphis, Joe Jackson, Jaren Johnson, Mike Dixon, Chris Crawford, and they were awful. The Tigers were awful, down 34 at one point. They lost by 21 while Marcus Smart abused basically anybody that Josh Pastor put on and finished with a career-high 39 points. I want to talk to you about Marcus Smart in just a second, but first let me ask you about Memphis. The headline on your blog post read this way, "Business as usual, Memphis can't win a big game." What did you make of that performance?
I was really, really disappointed. And I'll tell you what, it's one thing to lose on the road to a top 10 team with, you know, a national player of the year. Marcus Smart obviously wanted to go out there and make a statement. You know, we knew he was going to have a big game because nobody was talking about him. He's one of these competitive kids that, you know, he wants to win. He wants to be the best. So I think we all kind of knew that he was going to come out and do something. What bothered me about Memphis is that it looked like they kind of rolled over. There was no fight. When you're getting embarrassed like that and when you're getting beat up, you know, you need somebody that's going to step up there and be like, all right, you know what, enough of this. I'm going to go out there and score. I'm going to get a stop. Marcus Smart is not going to get another open look at a three on me. And it looked like instead of, you know, fighting through it and playing with a little bit of pride, they almost rolled over and accepted it. And you know, that's what bothers me about it. You can lose a game. You can have a bad night. You can shoot poorly. That doesn't matter. It's the body language. It's fighting through it. It's playing hard. And, you know, I don't think they have that. And, you know, the comparison I always make is the Red Sox before they won that 2004 National World Series. Is, you know, it seemed like every game they went into, every World Series they went into, every playoff series, they always expected to lose. And they were like, all right, what are we going to do now that's going to embarrass ourselves and going to be another devastating loss? And I feel like that's almost what it is around Memphis with these, you know, when they come to the big games. It's 0-13 against the AP top 25. And, you know, if you count, St. Mary's was number 25 in the coaches' poll when they beat them in the NCAA tournament last year, coming off a playing game. And I think that you can qualify that as the only quote unquote big win in Josh Pastner's tenure. And, you know, that has to change. You can't do that now that you're in the American. You know, you got Louisville and UConn, and Temple's going to be better than they are this year, and Cincinnati's going to be better than they are this year, and Houston and SMU are on the way up, so they're not in Conference USA anymore. So I think, was it you that tweeted out, can they apply to go back to
right,
Conference
USA? Yeah. You know, like you mentioned, you grew up in Connecticut. I think most people know this. You know, I grew up in Memphis and live in the area still. I host a radio show in Memphis, and people are fired up because this is a program that obviously – achieved an unprecedented level of success under John Calipari, but they still treat themselves and conduct themselves as a legitimate top 25 program. They're top 25 in attendance. They're top 25 in recruiting rankings. They're top 25, in fact, top 15 in what they paid their coach. Josh Pastor's making $2.6 million a year, and yet they quite literally never beat top 25 teams. 0-13. I can't, and I posed this question yesterday on the radio. I'd be curious if you have an answer for it. Can you think of any other program that considers itself a top 25 program that's lost 13 straight games to top 25 teams?
No, I can't. And at this point, it's almost, you know, they need a change. And I feel like you would know this better than me, but is there a lot of pressure coming from the media and the fans for Pastor to kind of get this thing turned around? I know that Jeff Calkins wrote a column yesterday that basically said, you know what, Pastner still can't coach.
Oh, the pressure is off the charts. And after what happened, listen, it's one thing that I honestly believe that you could have taken Kentucky, Louisville, Michigan State, practically anybody, and put them in Gallagher-Iba Arena on Tuesday night, and they'd have probably lost that game, right? With the way Marcus Smart got it going early and the crowd, I just think you're probably losing that game on the road, regardless of who you are. But here's another question for you. How many times can you remember, like, a legitimate top 25 team, not somebody who, not an NIT team or not a, you know, a Sun Belt team, a legitimate top 25 team that's down 34 points to anybody in a 40-minute basketball game? I know it happens, but it's very rare. People lose by 20 all the time. I get that. But to be down 34, like, that's a big number. You don't usually go down a 34. So people are, you know, like, you know, the way it happened has people ratcheted up a level. The 0-13 against the top 25. Because, you know, you got to remember, what happened to Memphis the other night happened to them last year and the year before and the year before. This is the fourth straight year that that program has entered the season ranked in the preseason top 25 based off of recruiting rankings and a roster that seems obviously talented, and then you get run off the court by Michigan or run off the court by last year VCU or run off the court this year by Oklahoma State. And it's a pattern that, not saying it can't get turned around, it's still only November 21st, but it's a pattern that's undeniable at this point, and it's troubling.
Yeah, you need to start winning those big games. I mean, I had this conversation about Belmont with someone, you know, after they went in and they knocked off North Carolina. That is a very, very good basketball program. But the reason you don't hear them in the same conversation as, you know, Butler or VCU or any of these other mid-majors is because they don't go out on the road and beat, you know, big-name teams, and they haven't done anything in the NCAA tournament. And until you go out there and you win those games that everybody's paying attention to, no one cares about a 30-win season when you're beating up on Tulsa.
No,
you got to win on national TV when everyone's paying attention against good teams and have people talking about you, and then you can kind of work your way up. It's one thing to have all this talent on the roster. It doesn't mean you get that talent to play together.
No, you're exactly right. And in fact, I'm glad you mentioned Belmont, because I spent a lot of time over the past couple of days talking about, you know, I dropped Memphis completely out of the top 25 and one rankings. And the reason was because I have for years, literally years, mocked people with the Poll Attacks column who have ranked Belmont, because I would always point out what good is their 25 wins or 28 wins? I mean, it's good. Rick Bird's good, and it's a good program. But until they had beaten North Carolina this past Sunday, they had not beaten a top 25 team since December 2003. Like, they had beaten nobody. They had compiled these ridiculous records. I don't want to say ridiculous, impressive records on some level. But they had done it against inferior competition. And every time they were matched, I'm talking about Belmont now, against a comparable team, a top 25 team, they had lost without exception. And if I was going to use that as a barometer for whether or not you should rank Belmont or not, I just decided I don't know why I should treat Memphis any differently. If my knock on Belmont was always, hey, congratulations, you won another league title in 30 games, but you haven't beaten anybody of note, then why shouldn't I hold Memphis to the same standard? And until Memphis changes that, with maybe a win at the Old Spice next week over Oklahoma State, or in the Jimmy V against Florida, or at Louisville, or UConn, or somewhere, but until they beat a top 25 team, I don't know how you can take them seriously and keep buying into the idea that these heralded recruits are finally going to be something more than they've been previously.
You know what the most disappointing part for me was? I expected Mike Dixon to come in there, and you're looking at a kid who's got a second chance. He's got a reputation for being, you know, kind of a really gritty defender, a bulldog on the court. I was hoping that he would come in there as a fifth-year senior and provide a little bit of leadership, a little bit of toughness. You know, he's been through the ringer. He's seen the worst that the media can throw at him. And I thought he would be able to come in there and kind of provide a little leadership and stability. And, you know, nothing. He got nothing. Marcus Smart lit him up. He was 1-for-10 from the floor. He looked lost. He looked nervous. I'm hoping that we can chalk this up to Memphis simply getting a little nervous in their first game of the season, going into a tough environment on national TV and getting jumped and having nothing to fight back. So hopefully, you know, they can kind of turn this around and you know, there's no denying the talent on that roster.
Sure.
And when you look at those four guards, I don't really see all that much of a difference between those four guards and the four guards that Missouri had back in 2012 when they won 30 games and won the Big 12 tournament. And you know, what was it, the Marcus Denman, Kim English, Phil Presti, that whole team.
Sure.
There's not a difference in terms of the guys on the court. You know, even, you know, I'd say that Memphis is probably on paper better than that Missouri team. It's just, you know, if you watch what they did last night or on Tuesday night, they didn't run any plays. They didn't run any sets. All that would happen is it would come down. It'd be that if the four guards around one guy in the post and they would just take turns trying to, you know, go one-on-one against the guy. And that's not going to work. Might work in AAU basketball, but that's not going to work against a team like Oklahoma State, especially on the road.
Yeah, it didn't work the other night. Listen, we've talked about Memphis a lot. We've mentioned Marcus Smart. I do want to talk to you specifically about him. You updated your Player of the Year power rankings. I guess it was yesterday. You have Marcus Smart number one. Why Smart over, say, Jabari Parker, Julius Randle, Doug McDermott, et cetera?
Well, because I was only trying to take into account games against real teams. It's really too early to do any of that, but it's kind of fun to have the argument, and you know, who doesn't love arguing about stuff like that? So I put him number one because I think that his performance against Memphis was the most dominant performance we've seen on both ends of the floor yet this season. You know, obviously, 39 points and 5 assists or whatever it was. It was incredible to watch, but he also had 5 steals and 2 blocks and kind of changed that game on the defensive end of the floor. He was one of the big reasons that Jaron Johnson and Mike Dixon combined for, 2-for-20 shooting. So right. I just think that his performance on both ends, you know, was completely dominant. And the thing that I really like about Marcus Smart, everyone talks about, you know, the great teamwork and all this other stuff, leadership. I don't know if you noticed this, but in the first half, they brought in a kid named Stevie Clark, who's a top 100 recruit.
Sure.
You know, big time score. He came in and he was clearly flustered playing his first game on ESPN. I think he had 3 turnovers on his first 3 possessions. He might have bricked a 3. You know, he got beat defensively one time. And they showed a clip of Smart on the sideline about to check in, sitting there, and you could see him kind of saying to CB, you know, calm down. You got this. You're not coming out of the game. You know, keep playing. And the rest of that game, I thought Clark was fantastic. He played that point guard role that he's really not used to. He knocked down some threes. He made a couple steals. He kind of ran the offense, got the ball where he needed to go, and just kind of that calming influence. And you know, I'd have to talk to Stevie Clark to see what that actually did for him. But you kind of look at that from afar and you say, all right, look, he got that kid back to where he needed to be, and that, you know, that helped them win. And it's little things like that that I think also helped that team. And, you know, it's just his leadership. You hear about it all the time, but you don't really see it, and that's an example of, you know, what he can do for a team and just in a locker room.
Another interesting thing that sort of materialized out of maybe not just that game, but out of the broadcast of that game, Jay Billis was talking about Marcus Smart, and he mentioned that Marcus Smart actually handled the Memphis scouting report, which is, like, you played college basketball. How have you ever heard of that before, a player handling a scouting report for a team?
No, that's impressive. I didn't even hear that on the broadcast.
Yeah.
That's really impressive.
As the story was, Marcus Smart and you know, some of the teammates get together at Marcus's apartment, you know, a couple days before the Memphis game, and they watch film on Memphis together, and then they Marcus took a scouting report to the coaching staff, and then they worked on it together. Which is like, I've sat in on coaches doing scouts. I have never heard of anything like that.
Yeah, that's fantastic, and I'm sure there's a Travis Ford joke in there to make somewhere.
I know. I was the other night as I was, you know, of course in Memphis, people were going, Jesus, can we get Marcus Smart to do our scouting reports going forward? So, but it's just I'm sort of with you. It's become a little cliche to hear people talk about, how great Marcus Smart is, you know, as a leader and a competitor. But then you hear another story that just reemphasizes all of it.
Yeah, and then you hear him talk about all this stuff, and he's just such a mature guy and insightful. And, you know, I'm 28 years old, and I don't think that I could handle myself anywhere near as well as he does. So just good for him. And, you know, at least we're kind of seeing that kind of the intangibles and all the, you know, he has every sports writer cliche ever.
Sure.
Gets written about him anytime anyone ever writes about him. So it's kind of nice to see that. Him live up to that reputation, because you don't see that too often.
But it's funny because, you know, like, listen, I love him as a player. I don't pretend to know him on a personal level. I've been around him. I've talked to him. I don't, you know, we're not buddies. But like, he's so impressive. But what's even more impressive is, like, you know, I just remember before he enrolled at Oklahoma State, he had spent some time with USA Basketball. And I've told this story before, but it's worth repeating while we're on the subject. You know, I talked to Billy Donovan about him and talked to Mark Few about him and Shaka Smart about it. Now, keep in mind, Billy has worked with some of the best college players, pros, and leaders, you know, that have been in basketball in recent years. Joakim Noah, terrific leader and inspiration to his teammates and all that stuff. You know, Mark Few's had a competitor like Adam Morrison, who, you know, I know people like to make Adam Morrison jokes, you know, about his NBA career, but that dude was a baller in college and was a competitor in college. And when you talk to Shaka, Billy, Mark Few, or quite literally anybody who's been around Marcus Smart, they all describe him as the absolute best they've ever been around, including the kids that they've actually coached. To get that kind of respect and admiration from not just the guy who coaches you, Travis Ford, but from Billy Donovan, Mark Few, and anybody who's been around you is really unique.
Yeah, you hear coaches kind of praise guys all the time. It's just coach speak, media stuff. You know, you don't want to go out there and give them bulletin board material. But the praise that he gets from other coaches is almost over the top. It's the same kind of thing that they would say about their guy if they were trying to hype their guy up and get him some good publicity. So I think that says a lot about him that, you know, everybody that he deals with respects him. And I think respect is a tough thing to earn in college basketball. It seems like he has it from everybody.
So this weekend, I'm heading to the Mohegan Sun, and I know you'll be there on Sunday as well. The idea, at least when I booked the trip, was to see a really good Louisville team against a really good North Carolina team. Now, we'll probably still see North Carolina against Louisville, but I don't know how good North Carolina is. Perhaps it's just because they were never going to be good. Maybe it's because they're missing two key pieces in Leslie McDonald and P.J. Harrison. Neither is expected to play this season. Let me ask you this very simply. You think we're going to see P.J. Harrison play for North Carolina again?
I don't know, man. You talk to people and you see kind of what people are saying. And I don't know if you follow Eric Prisbel
sure.
on Twitter, but if you go back and read through his timeline, just what he's been reporting on that story, he's kind of owned it. You know, I think he spent like a month or something like that in North Carolina.
Right.
And his what he's been saying is that, you know, that in about early November, something changed. Maybe they found out that Harrison was lying to the NCAA or something like that. But something changed. And he went from expecting, you know, a short suspension back in November to expecting maybe half the season, maybe the whole year. So I really don't know what's going to happen there. I don't expect to see P.J. Harrison back anytime soon. And that's a huge, huge problem for North Carolina because, I mean, he's an All-American talent. If you take that kind of a player off of any team in the country, it's going to hurt them a lot. I mean, when you lose a guy that's good, it's just, I mean, it's simple. You don't need me to tell you that. That's just the way it is. And the thing with North Carolina, what makes it even worse is that losing him and McDonald means that they have no backcourt depth, which means that Marcus Page has to slide over to the shooting guard spot. So they have another freshman running the point who's not exactly ready to run the point. And now you have Marcus Page sliding over to the two-guard spot where he spent a year and a half in Chapel Hill trying to learn how to be the point guard to run that system. So it's just you take a guy who's done everything he can to learn one role, and now you got to shove him into another role because he got a guy that's suspended. It's not the best way to win basketball games. So if they don't get P.J. Harrison back and Leslie McDonald back soon, you know, I don't think that this is an NCAA tournament team without them. And with them, you know, maybe they're borderline top 25 right now, but you got to see it all come together.
Yeah, I listen. I'm with you. I watched on Sunday afternoon the Belmont game, and you look out there, and I sort of wrote about this very briefly, but, you know, you see the Carolina uniforms, and you see the Dean Smith Center, and you see the Hall of Fame coach on the sideline, but the guys in the uniforms, like, those aren't Carolina-level players, or at least typical Carolina-level players. Now, some of it's because, you know, they're missing two of their top five, probably, but, you know, James McAdoo hasn't developed into what I don't think most people thought he'd be coming out of high school. Marcus Paige, like you said, is now playing out of position. And the other guys, with all due respect, probably should be role players for Carolina more than, you know, guys that are having to be relied on in this way for Carolina. And when you look at it from that perspective, I'm with you. I don't know that they're an NCAA tournament team for sure.
Here's the thing about North Carolina. Everyone talks about their point guards, their fast breaks, all this other kind of stuff. When you look at the best teams that Roy Williams has had, his 2005 team, his 2009 team, and, you know, the last couple of years, the best teams always have one guy on the block they can throw the ball to where you know he's either going to get a bucket or he's going to get fouled, and it's just a presence on the low block. Sean May, Tyler Hansbrough, Tyler Zeller. Who do they have this year? Joel James, Bryce Johnson, you know, Kennedy Meeks, Desmond Hubert, those guys don't scare anybody. And look, they're not bad basketball players. They're playing at North Carolina. They were top 100 recruits. You know, they're good. But they're not low post presences where you can give them the ball, you take pressure off the wings. They're not going to beat people up and down the court over and over again. It's just they don't have the kind of roster makeup that you're used to seeing from a North Carolina team. And that's a problem because, I mean, Roy Williams can coach. He can coach a system. But I think he's a guy that recruits to a system, not that builds a system around his recruits, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And, it'll be interesting to see them up close this weekend. I'm actually going to be there on Saturday and Sunday. So I'll see them twice, regardless of what happens. But, from a distance on television, this does not look like a typical Carolina team. There is one last thing I want to talk to you about before I let you go, and that's another story that developed on Sunday that's gotten a lot of national attention, either for obvious reasons or poor reasons, depending on who you're talking to. But it's the Grinnell College situation with Jack Taylor scoring, I guess it was 108, 109 points this time. It was eclipsing the 100-point mark for the second time in less than a year. What level of college basketball did you play?
I played Division III.
Okay.
The team that I played for probably would have been like a notch below Grinnell. Grinnell's probably like a good high major program at the D3 level, and we would have been like Toledo.
I got you. Okay, so help me then understand this. I think we both agree, and I think everybody will agree, it's gimmicky. This isn't like a kid going out and scoring 100 like Marcus Smart went out and got 39 the other night in the flow of a normal basketball game. It is designed to create these type of opportunities. But what do you make of Grinnell and the coach and sort of what they've turned these exhibits into?
You know, I don't necessarily have a huge problem with them trying to get this kid all these points and setting records. You know, I think that it's kind of fun. And, you know, if I was playing on that team back then, I would have been like, you know what, let me be the guy that shoots. I want to score 100 points in a game. So the issue is that, one, the way they're doing this is they're going out and they're bringing in teams that just have no business being on the same court as them. It'd be like North Carolina bringing in the school that I played for,
right,
and trying to get James Michael McAdoo 100 points in the game. It's not competition. It's not an actual basketball game. And the issue, I think Doyle raised this, is this so the coach can sell a book? You know, I think he released a book in August on the system. And, you know, I don't have a problem with the system. When the system is running right, when they're not just force-feeding one guy, when they're not giving up layups so they can get the ball back that much quicker, you know, the system actually works. And what they do when they're really playing, you know, they were on TV back in 2005 on ESPN playing Beloit. And what they actually do is they just kind of go on hockey shifts. They have three or four groups of five, and they bring people in, and you just go out there and you sprint and you run around for 60, 75 seconds. You get up as much threes as possible. You try to force as many turnovers. It's almost like if you took VCU,
sure,
and put them on steroids.
Right.
That's kind of like what the system is like. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's actually fun to watch. It's fun to play. Everybody puts up big numbers. Everybody's getting playing times. I think they have 19 guys on the roster and 13 guys average double figures minutes. So you want to go play for him. There's nothing wrong with the system. What's wrong is these games where they try to force feed one guy and set records and get attention and sell books. You know, people have a problem with that. I kind of have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with the system, and I don't have a problem with Jack Taylor. I think Jack Taylor's a good kid. We actually had a story on the site yesterday about him. He shredded his knee when he was in high school. He did his ACL, his MCL, and his meniscus. He was a D1 recruit before that. You know, he got it all healed up. He became a born-again Christian. He had settled on going to Grinnell instead of trying to get a Division I scholarship somewhere. And you know, he works hard. He's a good kid. He gets good grades. So I don't have a problem with Jack Taylor. You know, I have an issue with the way they run those high-scoring games. But, I mean, I think it's kind of overblown. It's fun. It's a little bit gimmicky. And you know, I wish they weren't trying to score 100 points on teams that weren't good at all.
You know, it's yesterday you mentioned Greg Doyle, and he wrote a fabulous column that's getting a lot of attention sort of about this situation. And I was talking to Greg yesterday, and he and I both agree, I think, more than we disagree. But he took it a step further than I think I'm willing to go. And I'd be interested to get your perspective on this because you were a Division III player. Greg's point. One of his points, because I don't want to speak for him, but one of his points was that it's shameful for Grinnell to embarrass and humiliate these kids from Crossroads College because they then look up on ESPN, they see themselves on SportsCenter, and they're the butt of the joke, and they're humiliated, and that's just an awful thing to do. And my response to that was, I can't imagine that the kids at Crossroads are really embarrassed or humiliated, because when I see the score or the statistics, I don't go, oh, those kids at Crossroads must have sucked. It just doesn't even occur to me to think of them that way. And I even took it a step further and said, I bet you on Sunday night they weren't embarrassed to be on SportsCenter. They thought it was the coolest thing in the world to be on SportsCenter, regardless the reason. Could you speak to that? Is there any scenario under which those kids are embarrassed, humiliated, crying themselves to sleep on Sunday night? Or do they think it's the coolest thing in the world to actually be on SportsCenter, even if it puts them on the other side of a 108-9-point performance?
Well, I've never seen Crossroads play. I don't know how good those guys are, but I know that some of the teams that we played were not good at all. Didn't have guys. They had guys that might not have even made my high school basketball team, and I didn't really play on that good of a high school basketball team. So I think when you look at it, these are kids that are going to college and they're playing basketball. It's almost fun.
Right.
It's like if I went to college and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to start playing the saxophone. It's not like they're out there. They're not on scholarship. They're not going there to try to make it to the NBA. They're going there to have a little bit of fun. And, you know, if that gets them up on SportsCenter, you know, I would have thought that was awesome if I got put on SportsCenter.
That's where I was, too. I could not get Doyle to come around to my way of thinking. He was sort of cemented in the idea that those kids at Crossroads were humiliated and embarrassed and probably watching SportsCenter and all upset that they were being mocked that way. And I just said that, I don't know, we never got past that point. But I knew when...
You know what the other thing is?
Right.
They're scoring 123 points in a game.
Right.
It doesn't look like they're out there, you know, getting whooped up on. So at least, like, if they were losing 173-8, that'd probably be embarrassing.
Right.
They scored 123 points in a basketball game. One kid went for 50. So it can't be that. None of us actually saw the game. All we saw was some jumpers from Jack Taylor and a final score and a box score. So it can't be that embarrassing if you score 123 points and one kid gets 50.
That's interesting. I knew when I had decided I wanted to talk to you this morning that I wanted to ask you about that because you have experience playing at that level. Well, listen, I know you got to catch a train to get to the city. So, man, listen, let me wrap this up by telling you, thanks so much for being here. Travel safely. And then I will see you at the Mohegan Sun, either in the basketball arena or at the blackjack table this weekend.
Yeah, I think I might end up donating some money to Mohegan Sun.
God knows I've done it before. Well, listen, thanks to you, and thanks to everybody for listening. And I appreciate you all being here at CBSSports.com, listening to the podcast, reading what I write, interacting with me, and the rest of us on Twitter. Remember, you can subscribe to the Ion College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. So make sure you do that. It's the quickest way, I'm told, to get your hands on the latest podcast. So go subscribe. It's free. And either way, I will talk to you again really, really soon. Take care.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right, buddy. I'll see you.